Yeah, this morning I think Jacko was talking about the results of meditation, the deep joys which can come up in meditation, and some people were asking questions about the pity and the sukha, the happiness and joy which comes up in meditation, to understand what it really is. So one knows what to look out for and what to recognize. And I often, it's something which is quite difficult to describe, to try and find a metaphor in ordinary experience for what this state of deep, profound meditation is like. And the only metaphor which I can really think of, which I use, and it's quite a startling metaphor, is that the pity sukha, the joy and happiness of the absorptions, is like the joy and happiness which comes from sexual orgasm. And it's much purer, it's much more intense. In other words, it's something which is unmistakable when the mind becomes concentrated and when joy arises in the mind, if you like, blows one away. And so because of that, once you understand that, I can say, instead of just saying it sort of perfunctorily, it's a great pleasure to be here. Having just finished a weekend in town talking to people all day long for 2 days, and sometimes people think isn't it lovely to live a life of a monk, just sitting in a monastery doing nothing all day? But many of you know that that's really not the complete story of your life as a monk. And that weekend which I just completed, even though it's almost like a year away now as far as my mind sitting here, it seems to be that when one speaks to another person, that one has to meet them. And meeting them means going into their pain. It means empathizing, seeing the world not from where you are but from where they are. And that is extremely tiring. I know that I was talking to someone once about this, and I think they were a sociologist, and they were saying that the current teaching or advice which is given to sociologists is never to get too involved with the problems and the pain of the person you're talking with. But to me that never really seemed to be correct. It seems the only way you can really talk and help is to go right into their problem. To go right next to them so you can really hold their hand. And then to gently take them out. You have to go in there first of all, go in close. If you stand off, you cannot really reach out to them, you're too far away. And so that's why sometimes it is very, very tiring. And the only way that you seem to be able to cope is by developing the meditation and the attitudes which arise from meditation. The teaching which I've been giving the last weekend, which I've carried on to the last day, it's a very, very simple teaching, but it's very, very effective. It's the old Chinese proverb of a journey of 1,000 miles. And it just starts with one step, finishes with one step, and all the way along the path, all there is just one step. It's very, very effective on learning how just to take one thing at a time. Just the person you're with is all one needs to think about. The breath one is breathing is all one needs to think about. Just this moment of this day is all one needs to really live. And that makes our life, it makes my life anyway, very, very easy and easeful. So much so that I was just considering that you started this retreat on Friday evening. I only started this retreat yesterday, but 24 hours is, again, it's a year away, it's light years away. How many days are left? I really don't know. because all there is just, the now, the moment. Living fully in the moment is a tremendous way not only to be at ease, but also to conquer this problem of being with the breathing. Being with the breath means being with the breath happening right now. Sometimes the meditation on the breath seems to be an enormous problem. How on earth do we do it? It's very simple. All you need to do is breathe one breath mindfully. And that's the breath happening now. Why is it difficult? Because we do complicate it, and also because throughout the rest of the day, throughout the rest of the week, throughout the rest of our lives, we don't do one thing at a time. We don't, the whole life, the whole journey of one step at a time is something which is foreign to us. Sometimes actually I'm quite amazed at how it is that you can live a very, well, I'm just speaking from personal experience, how you can live a very busy weekend, just on the go every moment it seems, and then come to meditation retreat, and just go through a little bit of tiredness, and then almost straight away get very, very calm and deep states of samadhi, of meditation. And it was something which really worried me actually when I first came to Australia, because I knew what I was getting myself in for. In Thailand, you could have more opportunity just to be by yourself and to be still and to practice a form of meditation, of meditation on the breath or whatever else. But here in Australia, I knew we'd be building a monastery, we'd be much closer to the lay community than I was in Thailand. And that means more work, more taking you away from the meditation cushion. It's a strange thing that whenever the talking, whenever the building was stopped, whenever the trowel was put back in the workshop, I could sit down on the meditation cushion and very, very quickly come back to where I was. To be very, very still. And often I wonder, what was going on here? Why was it that I always thought that to be able to make the mind very peaceful and still, you had to put hour after hour after hour into meditation. And not to be distracted, not have to do anything else, just to organize everything just around the meditation cushion. And it doesn't work that way. Because it's the attitudes we have in our life, the way we talk to other people in the vihara, the way we lay a brick, the way we drive our car from Perth to Mount Helena, the way we talk to someone on the telephone, that is the condition which will make our meditation peaceful or will make our meditation scattered. It's almost what we do outside of the meditation room is so, so important. And the reason is because this whole process, it is a process, a conditioned process of meditation. It's not that you do the meditation. Sometimes we think that we're driving the bus. But if you look very, very clearly, that there's no driver there. The bus is going. Sometimes that's scary. The bus is driving at 1,000 miles an hour and there's no driver. The process is going on. And once I realize this, you realize just how fortunate, how wonderful, how awesome it is that this process has led to here, where one is listening to Dhamma, where one is listening to teachings. And it's what Venerable Ajahn Chah says, what I say, the environment around us, that is what is going to make this meditation work, much more than whatever you do. Let the process happen. When a tree is growing, it doesn't decide it's going to grow, a tree just grows. A flower doesn't decide when it's going to open its leaves, it just opens its leaves according to the conditions, the laws of nature. And it's important to understand the laws of nature about meditation so that we can understand how meditation works and to understand, if you like, how it's done. Meditation starts, as I say, with what you do at home. It starts with, the Buddha kept on saying, it starts with virtue. When I was first starting meditation, I didn't buy into all that stuff. I just wanted to meditate. Why is it that some people can come and sit down here and become very, very still, and some people can sit down here for 1 day, 2 days, 10 days and never get still at all? You know, a lot of that is to do with virtue, what we do at home. If your meditation isn't going well, don't only ask, you know, what effort am I doing? What am I doing wrong here on the meditation cushion? Ask what you're doing at home as well. How you're living your life. What you're doing at your job and at your work. Is there something you can do with your virtue? Are you being selfish? Are you not looking after the people around you, including yourself? Are you not resting enough during the working week? One of the most important parts of virtue, again, is simplicity. And the simplicity of lifestyle. That's something you can do in order to make the next meditation retreat very, very peaceful and still. The virtuous person is someone who understands what is going to make their life easeful. To understand the results of one's actions of body and speech and mind, not just in the meditation hall, but at home as well, on the way to work, at the supermarket, everywhere. When one understands this, one starts to understand virtue. And the Buddha kept on saying that one who is virtuous, they become peaceful. And in a very lovely sutta, that the Buddha said that one who is virtuous, they don't have to decide, I'm going to be peaceful. They don't have to put any effort into becoming peaceful. They are peaceful. It's a natural result, an unavoidable outcome. One thing leads to another. It has to lead that way. This is nature. Another word for nature is Dhamma. So that's why virtue is indispensable to the peacefulness in our lives, the sense of going through lives contented, simply, not needing very much, not asking for very much, not always going out for very much. The virtue that leads to peace. And that sort of peace, you can see what happens when you come into the meditation room. That sort of peace is something you've been living all through the day, all through the week, all through your life. The peace which doesn't argue with people. The peace which is tolerant, which can accept different views of other people, different actions of other people. This is very important for the practice of meditation. And someone who is peaceful in their life, just this little contentment in the way you live your life, that joy comes up, happiness comes up. Just the smile on a contented person, the radiance of someone who is living their life without really bothering anyone, without bothering themselves even. Just, if you like, floating or cruising along. Then the Buddha said that someone who is peaceful, is content, that they become happy. And they say a person who is peaceful, they don't have to decide to be happy. They don't have to work to be happy. They are happy. It is a natural result. It is the Dhamma. And this very same sutta, that one who is happy, one who has this joy of simple living, of virtuous living, is someone who becomes concentrated. And he said that the person who has this joy, this peacefulness, this virtue, does not have to decide to be concentrated. They don't have to put forth, if you like, effort to be concentrated. They are concentrated, they become concentrated as a natural result. So one starts to understand here where this meditation is coming from. Sometimes if the meditation doesn't work, we think, what am I doing wrong? And sometimes we think, maybe I'm not watching the breath close enough. Maybe I'm not sort of putting forth, doing the right effort right now. Maybe I'm trying too hard. Maybe I'm not trying hard enough. Maybe I should sit up straighter. Maybe I've got the wrong meditation object. Maybe start from the very beginning. Start with virtue. Increase that, and you can start to understand why it becomes more easy to meditate on the meditation retreats. And why is much easier for, say, monks to meditate? Because the lifestyle of a monk is, it's just almost impossible to be unvirtuous. If you're unvirtuous, you get kicked out. Just the rules are just so tight. You've got no leeway. And that's why the Buddha established the monastic order. To give that foundation of virtue, to make it so easy to meditate if the monk is doing what he's supposed to be doing. And the concentration, again, I'm just amplifying what Venerable Ajahn Jagpa said very eloquently this morning, with this concentration that I like to use the word like settling. It's a word like samatha, which we mentioned this morning, which is the word in this Buddhist meditation for concentration. This settling of the mind is a very wonderful translation of that word, because it is actually used elsewhere in the Buddhist canon, in a little place in the rules of discipline, which make it very, very clear that that's what that word means. It's lovely to see these words used in different contexts, and then you get a really good idea what they mean. It's a settling of the mind. It's as if there's a wind and the wind dies down. And when the wind dies down, the whole forest stops moving. And this stillness there, this silence, is a lack of movement. Have you ever gone into the forest at night when it's still, when there's no sound, when there's not even a leaf rustling? That's what we mean by samadhi, by concentration. The complete settling of all movement, of all sound, of all doing, of all coming, of all going. When there's no coming, when there's no going, what's left is just being. Is the forest is just being still. That is magical. That is joyful. That is awesome. Again, awesomeness is another wonderful translation of pity, of this mental joy. When you start to experience the calm mind, like the forest at night, or like in the deep caves, or like the wilderness areas in the bush, where at times nothing moves for minutes, for hours. That just takes hold of the mind. That is the gives rise to the bliss, the awe, the joy inside. And it's important to, with these concentrated states, to realize that it's the joy and the bliss which is the main aspect of these deep meditation states. That is the thing one notices most of all in the deep meditation. Like to just, Ajahn Jagpa was describing the first jhana this morning, and the second jhana, we tackle each other, like first thought and second thought and all these other things, but it's the joy and the bliss which is what one really notices. And in this, the first of these concentrations, and it's important to notice this, even though one may not have realized or reached these states of absorption, these jhanas, it's important to know what the goal is like, so one knows where one is going, so one moves towards these states. The first of these jhanas, it's the joy and the bliss which is born of like detachment, seclusion. It's not the first jhana born of detachment or seclusion. It's actually the joy and the bliss itself. That's where the joy and the bliss are coming from the sense of seclusion, detachment. It's the Pali word is called viveka. And the way that word is used, if say someone goes off into the forest, say like a monk just goes off just for a few days of silent meditation, off into a mountain or into a forest, they say like he goes into viveka. Like he leaves aside the monastery and his duties and responsibilities and everything else, and he goes to a quiet place. And the idea of viveka is like leaving aside things, especially leaving aside one's business and duties and responsibilities and everything else. And that's where the joy and the bliss, which is the first jhana, comes from. The more one can leave things aside, the more one can let things go, then the closer and closer one comes to the first jhana. The more and more the joy and the bliss start to grow, the more one leaves behind. And that's where the little proverb of the journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step. It becomes a very good description of what we mean by viveka, of seclusion, of detachment, of letting go. Because on that journey of 1,000 miles, if one looks at it one way, it's just a grind all the way. 10 days meditation retreat, and you're only on, what day is it now? I don't know. There's a long way to go yet, and your knees aren't going to get better, the back's going to get worse. If you look at it that way, just imagine what you've got to put up with yet. You won't be able to make it. You have to give up. Another hour. Imagine what it's like in the afternoon. 4 o'clock. Another hour to go. Oh God. And that's where like the journey of 1,000 miles comes up. Because the only way one can walk a journey of 1,000 miles is just by walking one step. It's a step happening right now. It's the only step in the world. It's the only breath in the whole universe is the one you're breathing now. And that's the only one one needs to think about, to care about, to bother about. Actually, all the other breaths, they do not exist. They are figments, if you like, of our imagination. There is only one breath, there always has been one breath, there only will ever be one breath. That makes a journey incredibly simple and easy. All one needs to do, one doesn't even need to sit for 1 hour. One doesn't even need to sit for 5 minutes. One only needs to sit for one breath. 10-day meditation retreat is a doddle. 100 days, 10 years, 50 years meditation retreat without moving. All one needs to think about is, and to be able just to think about one step, what do you need to do? You have to viveka, to leave aside all those previous steps which you've made, with all the pain that's been there with them, with all the memories of joy and agony and despair which have gone with those steps which happened a moment ago, yesterday, last year or whatever. Leave those aside. That's what we're supposed to be detaching from if you want to get into bliss. If you want to understand what I mean when I say that this meditation is better than sex. Like, you know, every sort of salesman has to have their pitch, and that's not it works very well in this society. So one leaves aside everything else completely. One's duties, one's jobs, one's past history. I can't meditate, I'm hopeless. Every time I come here, it's always the same. Let that go, leave that aside. If you carry that into this step, all along the journey my feet have hurt. And if you carry that around into this step, your feet will hurt this step. And just be afraid of all the other steps you have to make. And so that meditation becomes incredibly easy. All one needs to do is think of the breath happening now. Even if someone has just sneezed, they've already sneezed, you don't have to worry about the sneeze which has happened earlier on. It soon dies out. Any sounds which might disturb you, never allow them to echo, to bounce back and forth in your mind. Allow them just to come in, and just as soon as the sound is gone, just with no remnant at all, and even lets go of the past that much, that as soon as my voice finishes, there's nothing left. One step at a time. One doesn't even hear the echo of the last step. One looks behind if one does, and one sees no footprints. All there is just this step happening now. This is what we mean again by viveka. Seclusion. Seclusion into the present moment, just right now. And the more one gets into the present moment, the more one secludes oneself from everything else, from all one's past history and duties, responsibilities, who one is, a whole lot to leave that aside, the more joy, the more bliss actually comes up. One starts to notice the joy in the meditation, and that joy is right in the moment. It's not outside. That's why one of the reasons why we are restless is because we're looking for that joy somewhere else, other than here, other than now. The joy is when 9 o'clock comes and we can go and lay on our beds. Joy is tomorrow morning when we have breakfast. Joy is when I can get up and go to the toilet. I've been sitting here since 6 o'clock, I'm dying to go. Joy is in the moment. So in meditation, we don't look for joy in the next moment, we look for it right here. In this breath happening now, in this part of the breath happening now, look and see. And you see a little seed there of happiness and joy, of bliss, right here now. Look at that, notice it, and one see it grows. One comes into this concentration onto the breath, the settling, or everything else, all the other waves in the past and the future, forward and backwards, all disappear, and there's just this little wave happening now. One looks into that wave very, very carefully, and one sees it's a very beautiful wave. And it gives great joy. Sometimes the beauty which brings up joy is something we never notice because we're always looking for it elsewhere. Remember in France when I was used to do walking meditation in the hall in the monastery in Thailand. The hall was a concrete floor. And doing walking meditation, we used to put the attention just a couple of meters in front of us and just walk backwards and forwards, just watching the concrete floor. And watching the concrete floor for hour after hour after hour after hour, I started to realize what a beautiful concrete floor that was. You know, concrete is incredibly wonderful. You start to see the shapes and colours in it, the textures in concrete. In fact, that after a while you stop and you're just looking upon that concrete floor as if it was the most marvellous work of art, as beautiful as a flower. It's amazing where I can find beauty. I can split out on a square centimetre of concrete. Now you know how you can put out on just a moment of breath. See, that's incredible beauty in there. If only we had the eyes to see, if only you took time to stop and see what's going on in there. Once we notice the beauty in just one moment of breath, again, it becomes very easy just to stay with the breath because it's fun. It's enjoyable. It's as if one is just in a garden, in the moment. And it's a beautiful garden. It's warm. It's fragrant. Of course one can stay in there. It's just like getting in there the first time. and just noticing, oh wow, see what's going on in you. So one stops looking outside. It's always as if one is taken to the very door of the garden. Like it's a good simile actually. The years ago when I was just turned 18, I went into Central America, and I went to visit the pyramids, these ancient ruins of the Mayan civilization. And I remember getting to one of the most famous and beautiful of these ruins at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan Peninsula. That's a few hundred miles to the west of Mexico City and south of it. Just as I was getting in, arrived there, this a busload of American students, they were on some sort of educational tour, pulled up. This was in 69. They'd been at the ruins for about an hour or two, and I was just getting blown away by them. Just, you know, the feeling there, the history behind it all, and because they were all like religious complexes, and I was becoming sensitive to what was happening. And these about 20 college boys from the United States got out. As soon as they got out, with all these beautiful temples and jungle around them, they got out their football and started playing a game. And I thought, my God, you know, there's all this around them, and all they can think about is playing football. Watching the breath with all this beauty and wonder and awe in this moment of the breath, and all we can think about is what we're going to have for breakfast tomorrow morning. All we can think about is going to sleep later on. All we can think about is just how many games of football do we play in the moment? Missing is this wonderful thing happening now. This is what we mean by the bliss and the joy of the moment. If I can only open up to it in this very instant of the moment, and it becomes very easy. And our life becomes so easy. Whatever we're doing, we can see beauty and joy in the moment. That's the first jhana. It's still quite coarse. The second jhana is, again, bliss and joy is the main aspect. This is, the second is the bliss and joy of concentration, of oneness. Even though there's wonderful things going on, beautiful garden. The second jhana, or the second absorption, is as if one is in a, one is left behind a very coarse world of past and future, of doing and making, and one goes into this wonderful garden of the present moment. The second jhana is if one just chooses one flower, instead of just having all the whole garden. A garden of flowers is very beautiful. It is quite coarse compared to the beauty of one flower. The second jhana is concentration, is oneness of mind, is being with one thing. Stillness again, calming and moving, coming just to a very, very deep rest and stillness. So I wanted just to point these few things out about what this meditation is going through, to point out, first of all, that the first part of the meditation, if one is doing calm meditation, is we wake us. Is leaving behind, letting go of things. It's much more important than even effort or mindfulness. Of course, mindfulness is tremendously important. You know, one has to know one is leaving things behind. One doesn't really see, one doesn't know what one is carrying with one. Let go of all one's burdens. Let go of all the past. Let go of all one's hopes and all one's fears. Sometimes it is a bit fearful because we've been carrying these things for so long, we don't really feel like we're comfortable with them. We don't feel like letting them go to go into a deep jhana. But it's worth it. We wake up. Let these things go. Seclude the breath from everything else. Go into the deep retreat inside, and don't take any books, any diaries, any memories in there with you. Get all that aside, let it go, detach, and come into the garden. And then once you're into the garden of first jhana, instead of this beautiful garden, just choose one flower to stay with that. Again, I'm talking in similes here, and again planting seeds so that in future times, or maybe even now, I'm not quite sure, that those seeds hopefully will come up and will remind you what these deep meditation states are all about, and they're extremely useful to give pleasure and to give joy, to clarify the mind, so one can have some wisdom. But because we have been doing Anapanasati for a long time, for 3 or 4 days, and I know that I was talking to Ajahn Jaggaro just at tea time. I was asking what I should really talk about this evening, if he had any advice, so I can put this talk in context of the whole retreat rather than just giving a one-off talk. And he was planning to very soon to turn the emphasis away from just the calmness into more the developing of wisdom. And so I wanted to also talk about a type of meditation which I do. I talked about it before, which is very useful at this particular point, almost as if it's halfway between a wisdom meditation and a calming meditation. And that is that the meditation on emptiness. Because the meditation on emptiness has both aspects of calm and wisdom. Meditation on emptiness, again, is as if we have all of these knick-knacks, these heirlooms, these things which we are very concerned about, the sorts of things which we would like to carry out if our house is burning and keep with us. And we do actually take these things into our meditation with us. In the meditation on emptiness, we have to leave all these things aside, we have to let them go, we have to empty them out. To go into the meditation on emptiness, we have to go in there empty-handed. This is very, very important. It's as if we've got all this furniture in the room, and you have to take it all out. Even your favorite meditation cushion. How can I meditate without my cushion? Everything out on the meditation on emptiness. Again, I'm speaking metaphorically here, so you don't need to go and sit on the carpet. The idea is on meditation on emptiness, to just empty out the mind one by one by one by one. Don't allow anything in there at all. Any hope, any fear, any desire, let it all just disappear. Meditation on emptiness, again, that's remembering again the time when I went off to Central America, because there's a very beautiful simile here which I've used before on emptiness. It's again, when I used to go to these places, I didn't know anything about the Mayan civilization. Or I knew that there were supposed to be some sorts of religious objects, these pyramids. I don't know how they found out, but they said that's where the priest used to go, to the very, very top. And actually, on the top of those pyramids, there used to be a little room. Only maybe about 5 foot by 5 foot, with a stone roof on it, and just one door in it. But in those days, 69, there was no fees to be paid. You can just wander all over those complexes by yourself with no one to stop you. Climb right to the very top of the pyramid. And that's when you start to see emptiness at the top of the pyramid. Because throughout the whole of Central America, certainly in 69, I don't know what it's like now, but it was jungle, very thick jungle. And when you're travelling in jungle, that you could never see very far. Even above you, it seemed to be on the roads, but the trees used to arch over the gravel tracks. And just for weeks and weeks, you never saw the horizon. You never even saw the stars. I just remember even in the monastery in Thailand, in Wat Nana Chat, it was very rare to see the stars. If you did, you just saw them through to a small gap in the trees. You never saw the whole hemisphere of the heavens. And I remember speaking to people in Fremantle Jail, that there too, that because that there's big walls, high walls all around them wherever they go, that it's very rare they actually look up above those walls to see the sky. And people who've been in that jail for many, many years, for 10, 15 years, just their eyes just forget to look at distances. They forget infinity. And they say the very first time they get transferred out of that jail to one of the farm prisons, again it just blows their mind. They can see the horizon. And I can imagine that, at least I imagine, that a person living in these jungles, not someone like me who'd just gone there for a couple of weeks, but people were born in the jungle, who lived all their life in the jungle. So imagine what that would do to them if they climbed that pyramid for the first time in their lives and they saw the horizon. They saw empty space with nothing between them and infinity. No obstruction of the absolute. This is what we mean by the meditation on emptiness. To be as empty as the sky around a pyramid. It's obvious to me after that why those trees, where they got all their inspiration from. They go up in that pyramid and they just blow out. It's just their minds would just expand just so far. And they would understand that simile of arising above the jungle of our concerns and thoughts, doing this, doing that. And for the first time, just to see emptiness. The sky is a wonderful simile of emptiness, especially a day when there aren't any clouds. The mind does go right off the very edges and beyond. And emptiness becomes a wonderful, wonderfully peaceful abiding. It's so much bigger than us that we tend to get lost in it. And our I, ourselves, just disappear. And just sit there, just watching, being empty. That's why the emptiness does require a bit of wisdom and a bit of calmness to be able to climb that pyramid. Because if we climb that pyramid with all of our belongings, we never reach the top. It's just too heavy. We have to keep letting go of everything and everything and everything. So when we do meditation on emptiness, and I did a meditation on emptiness, start to see what's in my mind and let go of things one by one by one by one. Let go of all past and all future, all hopes, all concerns, all fears. See what you're carrying. This is a concern in the mind which goes on and on and on and on and on. That's something you're carrying. Let that down, let that go. If it's a desire to achieve something in meditation, certainly let that go, leave that alone. Right, tamai. With a very penetrating gaze. And I said, I don't know. I wasn't quite ready. Well, I always remember that because, you know, it was obviously that he was really giving me a very deep teaching there. I was very privileged there that, you know, he saw me there and he was there and he thought that I was ready for this and composed enough. But what he did do, which, you know, is great wisdom, he gave me the answer. And he said, if anyone ever asks that of you in the future, he said, the answer is this. He said, my Mirai, there's nothing. The answer to the question why is not, what did they say, Hitchhiker's Guide 49, isn't it? That was the wrong answer. The computer should have, 42, yeah. The computer should have got the answer as, there's nothing. And I often contemplated that because of that situation, and because it was Ajahn Chah, a great teacher, said it to me. The answer to why is nothing. Most of the time when we're meditating, we're asking the question why. That's why our mind doesn't stay still. We're asking why all the time. That's the movement behind the restlessness which stops it becoming still. The answer is, there's nothing. Remember that answer, there's nothing, and you become still. And you understand the meditation on emptiness. There's nothing anyway. There's nothing. So there's a very... Once you start playing around with these thoughts, you start to... you start with a thought, but you start to go to the meaning behind the thoughts, which is the purpose of all thoughts and sayings like that. So don't just philosophize about these things and have one thought give rise to another thought, give rise to another thought. Just say that to yourself now and again in the meditation, and then stop and see what happens afterwards. After we say these things, for a moment we see the meaning. That's almost like the next thing which happens after we say a word to ourselves, like a thought. The meaning just comes, but if we're not quick enough, we lose the meaning and another thought comes up. Say the thought and notice the meaning. And once you notice the meaning, stay in the meaning. Stay in the meaning of there's nothing. Stay in the meaning of emptiness. And that's a very quiet and wonderful place we can abide. And that's not hard to do. That doesn't need so much training. But again, as I started off by saying, these things will happen by themselves. No matter what you think you can do and you can't do, you will get concentrated. The mind will stop. The seeds have been planted. Whether it's today or next year or next lifetime, the seeds are there. Be patient. It'll all come together. So has anyone got any questions about what I've said this evening? Something completely different. It's all the same. Practice it. Yeah, okay. It's in the practice, whether it's anapanasati or whether it's the meditation on... I'll start with the meditation on the breath. When you're watching the breathing, in, out, you know what the breath feels like? As the breath gets quiet, the perception of the breath changes. Actually, a very good point, which thank you for bringing up, because if you want to go into these very deep states of meditation, allow the perception to change. Because the way you see a breath when you first start in meditation, and as you get deeper and deeper, it becomes very, very different. In fact, the way you perceive the breath when you're in deep meditation is a body of bliss. It's not as if that the bliss is in the breath or the breath is in the bliss. The breath is bliss. So that whatever the mind, as you start to watch the breath and as everything starts to quieten down, it's as if the colours start to change of the breath, like a chameleon. It's the same chameleon there, it's still the breathing, going in and out very, very subtly. But it changes its colour, so you actually perceive it in a totally different way. And like you can even do the breath meditation and look upon the breath as emptiness. And the breath is emptiness, and emptiness becomes the breath. It's just the facet of that thing which you perceive, which you put your attention on. And I say that because no one taught me that. That's something which I had to discover myself. That in watching the breathing, sometimes I thought I'd lost the breath when you started to get some joy and coming up, and I said, well, I better go back to the breath. Just allow the process to happen. You get out of the way. You start the process off. You get the car going up into first gear, second gear, third gear. Once you're in fourth gear, go into cruise control. and get out of the way and just watch the whole thing quieten down. Allow it to quieten down. Don't disturb it. And the different perceptions which you will see, you'll feel that it's becoming calmer and calmer and calmer. And that's what the meditation is about, calming the mind. And the character of a calm mind, or the way one recognizes it, is by the degree of joy and bliss. That's what a calm mind feels like. That's why I often say that, you know, there's no doubting when the mind is concentrated, when it's at peace. You can't miss it. No more than you can miss when you're having sexual intercourse. These are very powerful feelings inside of one. So what I'm saying is that go for this very, very peaceful state of mind. Allow it to happen. Notice the joy, notice the peacefulness, notice the emptiness. And even have that as the object of meditation. It's still the breath, really. After a while you see it, it's still the breath. But at first it just thinks that you're just switching off to joy, switching over to joy, or switching over to emptiness. It's just the mind becoming quieter and quieter and quieter. The process. That's where anatta comes in, of no self. You don't do it. It's all the conditioning which you've had in the past. It brings up the quietness. And the teachers and the teachings are part of that conditioning. That's why planting these seeds in is a beautiful thing to be able to have seeds planted. They will bear fruit. Yes, really.
And
when I
craving.
Not really, because craving is a very... Actually, when you're in the States, it's not a source of craving. It's afterwards, when you come out of them. You forget. But inside of them, they're very, very peaceful, actually, if there's craving there, that it can't, that those states can't really survive this craving inside, and they're more pure, too pure for a craving to be in. It's afterwards, when you come out of these states, that you can get craving for them. And that's what happens if you have craving for these states, you find out you can't get them. And so that it's one of those strange things that if like desire leads to loss of desire. You really crave these states. The first time, it's one of the common problems for meditators. The first time you get into these states, wow, this is it at last. You find you can never get in there again for a while, until you realize that the thing which is stopping you attaining these states the second time is that you've tasted the fruit, and my God, you want it again. And you do anything, you give an arm and a leg, and that's why you're willing to go through all this pain. You get these things, and you realize that that's what's stopping you. And you understand, or at least took me a while to understand, that it's the reason why those states come up is from the abandonment of craving, from the awakening, from the letting go of those things. Those states don't arise from craving. Craving is the condition for them to not get anywhere near there. Craving is like tying a chain to yourself when you're going up the pyramid. You can only go up so far and you can't pull that chain any further. You can't get up. You're stopped. So that, no, craving is not really a danger, because in those states there's no craving. And after you get those states, as long as you crave, you never get those states again, and that disappoints you. And that's the condition, that disappointment for giving up craving, because you try once when you meditate without that craving for those beautiful states, and you get them, and you realize that those states come from abandoning craving. But they are, if you like, the carrot which encourages you to abandon craving. It's much nicer to give up the craving and get into those states. So it can seem like a while when one doesn't really understand that one is blocked for a while for the joy and delight of those states. But It doesn't stop the process. It's not a spanner in the works. It's just part of the whole thing.
When you feel guilty when you're in those states that you should be studying a new gym and not.
No. Because in those states, I mean, there isn't those thoughts at all. I mean, that you're guilty. It's as if that once you go up that pyramid in that very rare air, I mean, you're not interested in taking the radio or worrying about all that babble of guilt. And indeed, what you're talking about is the arising of wisdom. And it's the whole calming of the mind and understanding the whole process of all of these things is where you really start to understand anicca and anatta and dukkha. It's understanding it as a process. And as Ajahn Chah was saying this morning, the insight which arises. It's a strange thing. I think someone said, does it arise suddenly or gradually? I had that idea from somewhere, I'm not quite sure, but I think it was mentioned either in passing or directly this morning, because it comes up as a memory. The rising of insight, I mean the deep insight, which again blows you away, it's again like the arising of deep insight is another cause for the arising of pity, of great joy. And that's one of its signatures, if you like. And that happens suddenly, but also gradually. Just as one was going from one country to another country on a bus, the whole journey is gradual, just mile by mile, foot by foot, inch by inch. But there comes a point when one passes from one country to another country and one knows. There is a time when insight arises, very deep insight, even though all the conditions building up to that just age inch by inch by inch until they culminate in the great insight. And those great insights, the edging, the moving towards those things, depends upon the development of samadhi. Again, in one of the Buddha's famous discourse, oh no, it's not actually a famous discourse, but it's becoming more famous. It was pointed out by a monk called Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's called like transcendental dependent arising. It just shows how this whole process works. That once one does become concentrated, by its own nature, that gives rise to wisdom. It's not, again, following what I was saying earlier, it's not that once one is concentrated, one decides to contemplate anatta or anicca. It's not that one puts any effort into doing these things. When one is concentrated, that gives rise to seeing things as they really are. One doesn't do it no more than a flower decides to bloom. It's just a natural consequence of a concentrated mind. Sooner or later, it will see the truth of things. But that's not the end of the process, because once one sees the truth of things, sees what is really happening, once one starts to see anicca and anatta and dukkha, that gives rise to this feeling of disenchantment with the world. One actually sees that there's some work to be done. Once one sees the situation one is in, and that's when one starts to really let go. Not before wisdom. Not before concentration, but afterwards. After that insight comes along, one sees that one is, as Ajahn Chah used to say, one starts to see one is carrying a hot coal in one's hand. After all that time, one has to get into these deep states of meditation, or at least close to them. The deeper you get, the clearer you become. You start to see that there is actually something to do, you have to let go of something. And it's once one has seen the anicca, anatta, dukkha, that's when the work really starts. One starts to let go. It's a strange thing that why We can say letting go, but we don't let go. To understand it, because you have to see very deeply and clearly what's going on. And then that gives rise, quite naturally, that once you see that, you do let go of the coal. It's strange that not all at once. You've been holding that coal for so long. It takes time sometimes. Sometimes they say 7 lifetimes before you actually let go of that coal. It's a weird thing. But you have to let go of it once you see it's burning, sooner or later. Bit by bit. You let go and become free. So you don't really feel guilty at all. The whole thing is a problem. You get out of the way. You don't need to do anything. It's just allow the thing to work.
Afterwards.
Well, you don't decide to contemplate anicca, anatta, that you see them by itself. In other words,
If you feel that at this and afterwards, then you can say, I could have used that to give me any more insight than that.
Oh no, that doesn't really work that way, because that in the real bliss states, that's, if you like, there's no room for that sort of contemplation. And there's just the observation, the experience, the being with that state, and there's not enough wobble there to be able to start thinking things like that. And it's only afterwards, when one comes out, the mind starts to wobble into thought. When it's still, when it's peaceful, there's not even a cloud in the sky. And so it's afterwards. One comes afterwards with a very clear mind. But what happens is that when the Buddha starts to talk about anicca, anatta, dukkha, it puts these ideas in the mind, it seeds in the mind. And after the mind has become calm and peaceful and being cleaned out of all these other things which obstruct the arising of wisdom, this means spontaneously one starts to, these things start to arise from within one, and one starts to see anatta. One doesn't choose to take anatta as a method of contemplation. Just anatta comes up by itself. Anicca comes up by itself. Because these words are mentioned again and again and again, it's conditioned into the mind, and at the right moment they come out again. It's like something which I often say to people, that if you have something very important to say to someone, you've got an important interview, or you have to speak to your wife on a very delicate issue, never plan what you're going to say. Never decide what you're going to say. Just go in there and open up your heart, and you find all the right words will come out. You never need to plan insight meditation. Just open up your heart and see. You don't need to decide, right, now I'm going to do anicca. Right, now I'm going to do anatta. Right, now I'm going to do dukkha. Just open up your heart and they're all there. If you're going to see someone, an interview, or give a talk, just open up your heart and just allow it to come out. So that's my experience anyway, with the way of insight. And I always think it's also important, because if you choose what you're going to see, you miss so much else. With insight, it's much better just to open up your eyes and see whatever's here. Then you don't miss anything. You may be looking for anicca, and it's anatta, it's just staring in the face, but you're only looking at anicca. But just open up the complete eyes and you see, the one which is tapping you on the shoulder.
Can you get into the concentrated state without seeing the actual?
No.
So it's kind of different in the sense that, as you say, the breath is in the morning.
Yeah.
And you're ignoring the morning. So now how bad or how good you were or you're not there in the future, you're ignoring the morning.
But the moment has come from the past. It's conditioned from the past, it's grown up in the past. The past is gone, but the moment is just the continuation. So it is a conditioning process. This is really important to understand. If you look at any of the Buddha suttas, you see conditioning, conditioning, conditioning again and again and again. When the Buddha first became enlightened, he said, apparently the first words he said were arising, arising. The conditioned phenomena. This arises and ceases. Nothing arises and ceases. Nothing arises and ceases. So now this whole thing is conditioned. Once you see that it's a conditioned process, you find out how to work with this conditioned process. What do you have to put in there to get what you want?
So how do we know from your practicing that it's not of virtual activity
a right technique is a virtual activity. Check what you're doing at home. Check how you're living. I'm not talking about just a very superficial virtue. I'm talking about the general attitude you have towards life and the people around you and towards yourself. And the motivation behind your body, speech and mind acts. That's virtue. Check them out. Are you coming here for selfish reasons? Then it won't work. Be very pure hearted. Or like be pure in your body and speech, and you'll be pure in your mind. And you get to these very pure states. How can someone who's not very pure in body and speech get to a pure mind? Which is the pure mind states are these bliss states. These are all connected.
We're awed by the fact that we exist. It means that we are impure to a certain degree, as it happened on land. So, how far back do we go? Then we go back 10 years.
I don't know. It is true, though. I mean, that some actions which you've done years ago will stop you achieving these states now. Certainly. So the only thing one can do is to, even if one, say. So we've got another, 4 or 5 days left. If you start really behaving yourself now, it's a bit too late sometimes. So, but what it does, it does, because a lot of times people ask me, why is it that I can't meditate, or I can't get really into deep states of meditation? It's a conditioned process, there must be a cause there sometimes, but sometimes that conditioned process does stretch way back. I know one monk who actually is a novice, and then he was about to be ordained, but he decided, like, usually when you can become ordained, you're a novice, and then you're going to become ordained from a novice to a monk. He was about to be ordained, and he thought, it's my last chance. He just wrote for a novice for the day, and then became a monk the next day. And in between being a novice and a monk, being in Bangkok, he decided this is his last chance. He thought he'd get out of his system. But he set up for his meditation back a couple of years. 2 or 3 years, just that one night of stupidity. this is sometimes what can happen. Traditionally they say that there's some acts which you've done, which are going to put you back for a long time. Like really heinous acts. If they're like, it's really gross acts. They're like killing your mother and father, for example. And you're going to stop your meditation for a long time, do things like that. So it's what one can do if one wants to improve one's meditation. It's not just doing it right on the meditation cushion. It's the point I was making here. It's doing it right when you're at home, when you're at work. If you clean up that act a lot, then it may not work straight away, but eventually you'll start getting into the beautiful states of mind. It's an important cause, and it's a cause that is sometimes missed. And it's again one of the reasons why monks can meditate very well. I don't know if it's 10 past 9. Is that okay? Another question? Okay. Yes. It is practice. How do you mean? Yes. Well, a person. Well, the thing is, a virtuous person will become peaceful, and a peaceful person will become joyous. A joyous person will become concentrated. They will practice. It's one condition to the other. Again, I never meant to talk about anatta this evening, but you can see that underlying all of this is anatta. We always think we're doing it, but it's not. The practice is happening. One cause is giving rise to another cause. You think that you're decided to come here. I made the decision. Actually, I never made the decision to come here at all. That's exactly what I told me to come. That's very clear in my mind. I didn't decide to come here. But even here, I mean, you said that what influenced you to come here? The times you come here before, the talks you've heard, the previous meditations. We think I did it. I decided to come here. And you see how these things, one thing influences another thing, which influences another thing. But we just isolate one decision and we think it was me. We say, where does the practice come in? We think that, do we actually need to decide to practice? Make the decision? The decision becomes made. And we're watching it and we think that, it was me who made that decision. But these decisions are made. So why did I sit now? Like this evening that started sitting at 6 o'clock. Why did I sit at 6 o'clock? Because I sat at 5 o'clock. Because I sat at 3 o'clock. Because I sat earlier on. Because I heard a Dhamma talk years ago. It wasn't me who decided. I was just, I was a passenger in the bus. I wasn't driving. Go on. No, it appears to be free will sometimes. Yeah, right. Maybe it's not free will. How does that feel? Scary? That's why people are very scared of totalitarian regimes, isn't it? Because there's no free will. Why are you scared? Because effort is part of the process as well. We make effort because effort is conditioned as well. We make effort because we've had effort before. We've had effort because it's been encouraged by teachers. I make effort because Ajahn Chah made effort. Imitation is conditioned. Again, we have all these things. We always want someone to. We're always looking for someone who's done it, for a suspect in the murder case. It's just been murder. No one's done it. Interesting, isn't it? It's like I like it. It's like the old story of the Cheshire Cat. So the Cheshire Cat disappears, and all he's left is a smile. One of the most beautiful expressions of anatta. In English literature, the smile is still there, and it's a strange thing. You have the smile without the cat. You have a decision without anyone doing it. You can have the practice without anyone walking along the road doing it. You have the smile of the cat, and there's no cat there. You have a brown robe. You have brownness without any robe. Actually, all you're seeing here, you think it's a brown robe, it's only brownness, it's light. Brown light, it's not a robe you're seeing, it's brown light you're seeing. But we always think that if it's brown, it must be something which is brown. If it's a smile, it must be someone who's smiling. If it's a decision, it must be someone who's making the decision. Now, I can say these things and you think, well, that makes sense, but... not ready yet to give up me. There are volitional actions, yes. There's no one doing the volitional actions. There are volitional actions, there is pleasure, there's pain, there's bliss, there's meditation states, there's decisions, there's coming and there's going. Yeah, okay, that's good. Well, what does that mean? That's an important question. Yes? No. Of course, it's only the now. It hasn't been written before. I don't think so. How's a contradiction? No, it's not like fatalistic. These things are conditioned. We don't know what's going to happen next. So there's no script. If there was a script around, then we'd be able to see it and be able to find out what's happening next. But no one's written a script. It's an unfolding, which we don't know how it's going to unfold next. This one condition gives another condition, gives another condition. The most important thing here is that, just to bring this back to meditation, is that to understand the causes which give rise to the blissful states of mind. And it's not just our effort, our will, our understanding on this meditation cushion now which affect it. It's what's gone before also. Especially the way we lived our lives, the virtue. And also what we've heard in the talks, what we've read, what we remember from our past meditations, and our own wisdom. And that's why the Buddha taught to give the conditions so that people can become enlightened.
And you realise that no one is suffering?
Yes, it's the... Well, there's many places in the... That it is one of the really lovely books of the Buddhist canon is the Theragata and Therigata. These are like little poems written by people who became enlightened in the time of the Buddha. And they're very interesting to read because they're very, very simple. And they just, they don't really go into like the theory. It's more like a person's expression of what enlightenment was. So like how they explained it. And I'm sure there wasn't many monks and nuns who were enlightened that didn't have the ability to sort of express it in such beautiful ways. But there were many monks and nuns who did have these ability to express for others over the centuries what it felt like to be an enlightened being. And there's quite a few of them said that there is no such thing as a suffering being. But the way they put it is very beautiful and very profound. They say there's just suffering arises and suffering passes away. There's dukkha coming into being and dukkha passing away. And that's all there is. That was their description of existence, of life, of being. And they said it was just like a person waiting for their wages. That dukkha arising and dukkha passing away as long as their body still has life.
So it's like you wake up in the morning and you've had a dream, you don't go back into the dream. Say
if
you're
having a dream, you're doing a fire in the house without people.
So when you wake up in the morning, you don't
really think, oh, I'll
get back into that dream.
You get
that fever and that fire,
you feel
there's only
one thing. Ah, yeah, you're talking about other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I thought you were just talking about yourself. Well, it's... When is this dukkha and dukkha arising, it's... the condition of the Buddha of an enlightened being, and it is to be an example. That's also part of the process to teach. So that the, in other words, that the process of practicing, of attaining, of being enlightened, it continues. It doesn't sort of stop just at the point of enlightenment. There is that wonderful space after enlightenment until the final passing away, the 45 years which the Buddha spent teaching. And that's where the great help to other beings comes from.
But
only after that. Oh, that's right, yes. That's it. Well, that's really amazing. Just see what the Buddha did in those 45 years. Amazing. You don't need very long to, because in 45 years that you can create many other monks and nuns to take over for him. You can create so many seeds of more arahants. And those arahants, after they're enlightened, not all of them, but some of them teach, they create more arahants. And those arahants create more arahants in the time between their enlightenment and their death. And that's the way the whole thing keeps on rolling. But the Buddha once said, as long as there are arahants in this world, the Buddhism will still still be strong, still keep prospering. Because when you really think about it, someone who hasn't really seen the truth, who's not really enlightened, how on earth can they teach? They can sort of teach, but not really from their hearts. Blind leading the blind. But once a person has seen, then, I mean, they can do so much more than the one who hasn't. They're sure.
It seems like the only good that they can really do that time which they're getting lying,
yeah.
Turn around, you know, it's a die.
Yeah, but look at Ajahn Chah. You see what he did. I mean, I don't know how long he was teaching, but how many monks did he teach? How many monasteries did he found? What's his effect in the world today? And because of Ajahn Chah got enlightened and taught, and there's people sitting here today. How many people come to the talks in town? How many people have been touched by Buddhism because, you know, that he taught Ajahn Jagura? Monks in England, New Zealand. Just how many people has he helped? And that's just like Westerners, let alone the people in Thailand. And his influence is still felt. So that one person being enlightened, he creates a tremendous wave which spreads all over the world. One person who doesn't become enlightened starts to teach. And what do they really do? Even if they keep teaching for lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. They haven't got anything to teach. Except just like that, there's two things to teach. There's like teach how to make the best of this world, which is the band-aid solution. It's how to pop up, how to keep the old car going. That's one way of teaching. The other way of teaching is how to get rid of this car once and for all. We teach in the monastery that how monks can live reasonably in harmony in the monastery, so we don't have arguments. So don't get angry at one another. That's only band-aids. Let's just go for broke. Once and for all. Yeah, oh yeah, indeed. So as long as you're here, as long as you're here in the world, you teach that as well. But it's band-aid solutions. They're useful. If I get a cut, you put a band-aid on. But it's you also do something else as well. If a fuse blows in the house, the first thing to do is to find out, not just to replace the fuse, but find out what's caused that. Because otherwise, if you replace the fuse, and after a while the fuse goes again, it's dangerous. So be careful of the band-aid solutions. Do the band-aid solutions, of course. Have the car. But there's something else also which is important. Get off the wheel. It's one of the kindest things you can do. For all those bodhisattvas, it's one less person they have to worry about.
So how are the bodhisattvas keeping your foot from taking that last step?
Because of ignorance. Otherwise there wouldn't be bodhisattvas.
successful would be more benefit.
No.
The second will be good.
No. Because, like, instead of... Yeah, it... But no, instead of that bodhisattva just, like, even just having a... Actually, it doesn't even work that way anyway, because this is a process. And you cannot... after you really get into that, they call it into the stream, once you really got into the stream and start to understand the Buddha's teachings, you can't stop it. It's a natural process, no more than a flower can get start growing and then decide, I'm going to stop growing now and flowering, because look at all these other flowers flowering. If I flower also at the same time, there'll be no one next year to flower. I'm going to wait till next year. A flower can't do that, no more than a person can. This is an impersonal process. It's anatta, whether you believe it or not, it is. And so you can't stop the process. You can, you're on the bus there and you can shout at the driver, stop, I don't want to go to Nirvana. I want to sort of, I've gone so far, I want to get out and tell other people what bus to take. You can shout at the driver. You can shout and shout and shout until you realise that it's just not listening, but it's actually there's no one even in the seat there. You're just shouting into empty space. So that in the end you just give up that, the shouting. You're on the path, and the buzz isn't stopping, whether you like it or not. You're going to become enlightened. Not when you want to, but just when the conditions are ripe. When the sun is out, when the rain has fallen, after so many seasons, the rice ripens, gives forth the seed, and the seed drops. That is the life of the rice plant. But during that period, when it's given the seed, and